Hey everyone, this is Steve Mathis. Thanks for listening to the podcast show. Before we begin the show, I just wanted to give a little shout out to my new friends at BTOSports.com. BTOSports.com has teamed up with yours truly to provide you podcast listeners with a cool free deal. What you want to do is go to BTOSports.com and check out all the sweet stuff from Fly Racing, Fuel Graphics, O'Neill, Stella, FMF, Liat, and Vortex. They carry these lines along with pretty much anything else that you need for your bike or body. So you go there. The cool thing is, you order more than $100, and really, what's $100 these days? James Stewart has that much in his Lambo ashtray. Anyways, order more than $100, type in the offer code MATHES, M-A-T-T-H-E-S, in the coupon section, right when you're checking out, and you'll get a special deal. It's so special, they haven't even really told me yet what it is. So to recap, go to btosports.com, spend $100, type in MATHES in the coupon section upon checkout, and get some kind of hella super sweet deal. Remember to check out their closeouts at btosports.com is a proud sponsor of the BBMX race team. All right, on to this week's show.
Your brain may explode from listening to this show. We will not be held responsible if it does. What are you going to do about it anyway? You won't have a head. You have been warned.
Welcome to the BTOSports.com podcast show. Brought to you by Transworld Motocross. Hosted by Steve Mathis.
Welcome to the BTOSports.com Transworld Motocross Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Mathis, and with me on the line, finally, after many attempts and many times missing each other, I have Yamaha PR Director Tim Olson. Is that the right title, Olson?
I'll go with it. Officially, I am the Media Relations Manager for Off-Road Motorcycles.
Okay. All right. There we go. Now, for those of you that don't know, Tim has a long... he hasn't been at Yamaha that long, and before that, he's got a long career in the motorcycle business, primarily at Motocross Action for how long?
A hair under 11 years, and yeah. Before that, being the son of the world-famous Alan Olson, MXA tester extraordinaire.
Right, so you've been around the magazine business a long time, and it's interesting now, you've switched. You've 2 years at Yamaha, 3 years at Yamaha, something like
almost,
that?
Almost 3 years, 3 years in April.
Yeah, and so now you've got another hat on, and now you're dealing with the magazine kooks, of which you used to be one. So what's that like?
Does
it give you a new appreciation? Do you have anything you learned from the other side type deal?
Yeah, I definitely learned everybody's agenda is slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
But, anybody who rides a dirt bike is typically a pretty good guy. So right. They're pretty easy to get along with. Everyone's got their own quirks, but once you get to know them, get to kind of figure out what works with them and what doesn't.
Right.
It kind of becomes a pretty easy gig.
Yeah, really. So you do the launch of the new bikes as well as dealing with all the various, when you had a factory team, dealing with the factory team or dealing with the various support teams, right? The big part of your deal is...
Now, come on. I've got 6 factory teams. back teams or factory help teams.
Sorry, I didn't quite get the terminology right.
My main task is just spreading the word for our YZ, WR, and TTR motorcycles.
Right.
And a side part of that is using, our racing efforts, let's just say, to promote. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, obviously, big news for you was the 2010 YZ 450. What's that been like to introduce to the public? What's been the reception? And, it's a groundbreaking bike on many, many levels.
For me, actually, it's been one of the coolest things because when I started back in 07, that bike was just past the drawing phase. So mm-hmm. I've seen, the very rough prototypes, the half-new, half-old bikes, the all-new but all, fiberglass bodywork bike to mm-hmm. you know, riding the, you know, prototype to riding the finished product. And,
right.
I mean, without a doubt, it's definitely, you know, one of the best 450s built, and definitely the best Yamaha 450 built.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool bike, and even if the bike was terrible, which it's not, I applaud Yamaha for thinking outside the box and, you know, and revolutionizing the bike, and I think the other manufacturers will go that way. What has been the response from the media? I guess KTM won the MXA shootout. But did Yamaha win the Transworld one, I believe?
No. Kawasaki won the Transworld.
Oh, okay. All right.
Basically, the main thing was that, you know, it's a brand new bike, so it takes a little while to get used to something mm-hmm. as revolutionary as our bike. I mean, hearing intake coming into the engine, nobody's heard that before.
Yeah.
It's the first time where, you know, when you turn the throttle on, you don't not only hear the exhaust coming out of the back, but you hear that engine, you know, sucking in air for combustion. So there's just a few little things like that where, you know, the magazines, they ride so many different bikes that it takes them a little while longer than actually, I think, the average consumer to get used to something like that.
Yeah, I was surprised at how much MXA talked about that. I mean, I saw them at the Montreal Supercross. I got Troy Adams to ride one for the Canadian website I work for, and he commented right away. As a matter of fact, he pulled into pits, said, "What is this sound?" And, you know, we're like, yeah, it's the intake. It's sucking air, and from the top, it's not used to. And then he went out and did, you know, 20 minutes on it, came back, and I was like, he's like, oh, I totally got used to that sound. I mean, you know what I mean? It took him 10 minutes, and he was not even.
The funniest thing is Stuart loves that sound.
Oh, really?
He's like, can I make it louder? I just love to hear that when I crack it wide open.
Yeah,
you know,
just sucking air.
Right away.
Right.
I mean, it gives a real weird, you know, it's so immediate. Like, the exhaust, there's a little delay. This, there's no delay. It's like, you crack the throttle, stuff's happening.
Yeah, for sure. No, it's cool to see. And I bet you were pretty busy when that thing came out. You flew everybody from around the world to Bud's Creek. That has to be quite an undertaking.
Yeah, that was the excitement at the end of the year. Getting everything organized, that was the easiest part. Praying that we didn't have rain that week, that was like the miracle, because all leading up to it was like, that whole week rain, we're like, it can't rain, there's nothing I can do. But knock on wood, only the European wave got a little rain. All the American journalists had a great time, and it pretty much went off without a hitch, so we were pumped.
This goes to show you God hates Europeans. It's proven.
Adam won't go that far, but I was very happy it didn't rain on the Americans.
Yeah, for sure. No, exactly. Now, it was funny because you and I were talking maybe before the race or at the race, I'm not sure, and I was like, Olsen, you're on vacation now. You know, no factory Yamaha team to put PRs out and to deal with and media requests and all that, and you made a point of you're actually way busier with Yamaha's refocusing its racing effort. So is it quite a handful to try to keep six teams going and in the right direction?
It's a handful, but, I mean, luckily, all of our teams are really easy to get along with and work with. I mean, like Donovan Mitchell from Star, he's absolutely a dream to work with. L&M has a lady, Lisa, that's all she does. So basically, I'm just like the conduit. I just kind of get, you know, this is what Yamaha wants to, you know, focus on, and let them kind of get what we want, and then they can add in what they want. So we all just try and work together. I mean, the goal is to sell dirt bikes. So
right, yeah. And so for official reasons, the six teams that Yamaha's factory backed teams are.
Yeah, we definitely directly help, you know, six teams, starting from L&M, Star, JGR, Valley, Moto Concepts, and then the J-Law Racing Team.
Oh, so you're back on the J-Law Racing Team. I think some of that support had been pulled or something like that, from what I understood, or who knows?
Yeah, you know, last year, I mean, it's definitely changed a little bit. No, but we're definitely, this year, we are, you know, behind, you know, it's not just J-Law, obviously, Grant Langston. I mean, there's a bunch to the team, and we definitely think they're going in a right direction.
Right.
So, you know, we're happy to help him in his new direction, a new focus.
Yeah, he seems to be a little bit reformed. Imagine that. But, I mean, it's going to do nothing but help Yamaha because, you know, that kid will probably run up front at some point. And that's the main goal, right? I'm interested, I don't know how much of this is your territory or not, but I'm interested in knowing, like, the engine and suspension lease program that you've come out and presented to some teams. Are they guys taking advantage of that, or what do you see out there, or do you even know? I don't know if that you cover that or not.
You know, I don't know the full extent of the lease program. Uh-huh. I know that there are definitely some teams that have, you know, certain teams have taken up on the suspension lease program, other teams have taken up on the engine lease program.
Yep.
I know a lot of our teams work very closely with our in-house accessory division.
Yeah.
The GYTR program. So I know a lot of teams from Stewart's bike to Ivan Tedesco bike has a ton of their engine parts in it. I know, the Star Racing team runs a ton of theirs. So a lot of them use our, in-house accessory parts, basically, hop-up parts.
Right.
Which go through one of the most rigorous testing schedules I've ever seen. I mean, they're as close to production spec as you can get out of a aftermarket product.
Yeah. No, it's kind of cool. The GYTR is really branding itself as a hop-up performance place to be. So putting on your media hat, if you remember what that was, what do you think?
Not that long ago.
Yeah. What do you think of Yamaha's new direction? I mean, obviously you're employed by them. I don't expect you to go off on a rant, but honestly, what do you think?
My honest opinion is it is the correct way to go.
Yeah.
It's not that we sacrificed one team, but we went from one direct Yamaha team to six Yamaha teams. We went from, three Yamaha racers to, I think the latest count is 22 Yamaha racers.
Yeah.
So, the only negative to it is there's three less rides available from the Yamaha factory, but, in my mind, those three rides spawned, 18 other rides.
So, right.
I really see zero negatives in the overall picture of us.
And let's face it, too, your guys that you had under the factory Yamaha team weren't exactly setting the world on fire. There's a lot of money spent for not a lot of results. Now, that can go either way, but I think for bang for the buck, Yamaha's going to do better off this year. You know what I mean?
I would agree 100%.
Yeah. I mean, they're gonna have depth in the class. They're going to have winners in the class. And at the end of the day, they're on a blue Yamaha, I don't know. It just took a long time for this to come, and I'm glad Yamaha's embraced it. I think it might happen more, like you said.
Well, it's like this year we had 5 out of the top 10 in the Supercross class were on Yamahas.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, I don't think it was 5 out of the top 10.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that. And then if Dan Reardon could have stayed on the track, he was a shoe-in probably for top 10 as well.
That was spectacular.
It was. It reminded me of another rider that flew off right about there a couple years back.
Yeah, that was spectacular.
So how do you like your job? After years of being in the media end of it, how do you like it? What didn't you think? What happens more than what you thought it would? Something that's surprising you about your job that you didn't realize going in.
Well, I think the biggest thing that, I don't know how everybody else works, but I went from being where you're a magazine, it's 3 people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not a lot of, politics. There's not a lot of, we need stories. Here's some ideas. Go do it. A company with 1,000 people where everything's got to, go through the process of, approvals and, other things. And that was the single hardest part for me to get used to personally.
Yeah.
But this to me is the greatest job in the world. I get to hang out with all the magazine guys. I get to ride, which is obviously what hopefully most of us got in this industry for.
Yeah.
And I still get to do, the fun parts, the doing intros, only now they're my intros and I'm not just attending somebody else's intro. So I really have nothing bad to say about this side of it.
Just the bureaucracy of it, I guess, more than anything. Yeah.
Yeah, more than anything else.
You just can't go to Jody's office and be like, "Hey, Jody, this is what I'm going to do."
No. Tried that. That does not work. I can tell you that for sure.
Yeah. Really, huh? The magazine end of things, you were doing it for a long time. And let's not forget your short stint at motocross.com as well. You were the editor over there. It's a very competitive business. I just switched from RacerX to Transworld. I know how it kind of goes. Now that you're on when you first started at Yamaha and you're on the other side of the fence, was there anybody that looked at you a little different? Or maybe you had not a grudge, but something happened along the way? I mean, was there any sort of weirdness at first with other magazines? Because you were an MXA guy. You were branded an MXA guy for a long time, and for reasons we'll get into later, when you're an MXA guy, you're an MXA guy. So what'd you find when you first started?
I mean, I kind of went out of my way, especially because I started right after right before new bikes were launched. So I kind of came in right at May, and we normally do our new bike intros like the first week of June. So I kind of, I brought everybody in and just said, "Hey, I'm not Tim Olson MXA guy. I'm Tim Olson Yamaha guy.
Right.
I'm going to treat you all the same. I'm not going to play any favorites. you know, if you feel like there are favorites being played, don't hesitate to, you know, email me, pick up the phone, because, you know,
right.
In the end, to make it work, they all got to, you know,
yeah.
Call me on a moment's notice and not think that I'm going to kind of do any kind of, you know,
yeah.
Favoritism.
Well, I think your character speaks for yourself as far as when you were at MXA and stuff, you know, you were always a kind of a stand-up guy, and I think that helps for sure. Everybody kind of knows, hey, Olson's a good dude type deal, you know, but...
I've never had any issues, knock on wood.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was one, Olson. We won't get into it, but there was one.
It must have been so small that I can't even remember.
Well, it involves a YZ250F intro.
Oh, yeah. No favoritism there.
No.
Favoritism.
No, I'm not saying there was. There just was an issue. There was a small issue. We got to correct
small issue. Corrected at the 450F.
Yes, exactly. Let's talk about, okay, so your dad is Alan Olson, championship-winning mechanic, as we all know, at Yamaha. Filled in for Darren Sorensen when Darren fell ill and took Reedy. Did they win the title? They did, didn't they?
No.
They didn't win the title. That's right. Rookie won the title. Did the job that your dad couldn't do. But
I cannot say enough good things about my dad. If it wasn't for him,
yeah,
who knows what I'd be doing.
So how did your dad get in with the MXA wrecking crew? Like, and when? What time was this? What years were this?
Well, my dad moved out to California from Fargo, North Dakota.
Yeah.
Back in the late 60s.
Oh, okay.
A co-worker started him riding dirt bikes. And then just, you know, over time, he developed the skills he has, which are pretty good. Mm-hmm. Didn't start riding until he was 30, so.
Yeah.
In 1979, he got a ride with the Wheelsmith Mako, which was like the Mako shop at the time. And
right.
He just kind of befriended Jody from Wheelsmith. That's kind of where everybody hung out.
Yeah.
And then in 1982, Mako came out with a god-awful 490, I think it was, that kept breaking shocks. And at that point, Jody's like, you need to get off those things. They're going to kill somebody. And my dad started riding Jody's test bikes. And just that's kind of from there.
Like
1983 was the first test bike I got to ride, which was a 1983 CR60. And just kind of grew up from there. And I think my lucky star is every day that, you know, if my dad had never met Jody, who knows where I would have, you know, been at this time. But
your dad is one of the coolest people that I know. Always a great, nice guy. I mean, never joking, laughing, you know what I mean? Like, yeah.
I'm very thankful. Easy get along with guy.
So you were first in MXA on a CR60.
1983 CR60, first test bike.
I was going to ask you when you started getting in with the MXA guys, but clearly it was early.
Yeah.
Now,
so
did you get an orange helmet on that day, or?
No. In fact, it took me a long time to get an orange helmet.
Right.
I was one of the last.
So talk about just moving into. So did you go to school for it to be a journalist, or did you take any schooling to?
Yeah, I got a college degree in sociology from Long Beach State.
Yeah. The whole time riding for MXA when they needed it, or the whole time doing
I was the, you know, I was racing with my father every Saturday, and we were racing with Jody, so.
Right.
It was kind of like, here's some horrible Italian rubber boots we need tested.
Yeah, exactly.
Try them on.
Exactly. You were like the test monkey for all this stuff. Hey, Olson, somebody built a bike. We want you to test it.
I got to do a lot of fun things like that.
When did you start there, like, full time?
I graduated from college in the winter of 95, and I started with Jody, I think it was April of 96.
Oh, okay. So almost 10 years or so, like you said, just over a little bit. What was that like working at MXA? You just got to test everything and just honed your riding skills. I mean, what was it like just working there?
If you're a motocross enthusiast who, you know, enjoys riding dirt bikes, there's probably not much a better job on the planet, because if you think about it, you get to ride whatever you want, wear whatever you want, you know,
yeah,
without any expectations as far as winning races, dealing with your adoring fan base. I mean, your goal is to, you know, ride bikes, evaluate them, try and give the consumer, you know, all the relevant facts about the bike, you know,
right.
What works, what doesn't, what, you know. Of course, the flip side of that is you don't always get to ride the best bike. So,
yeah,
you know, for how much you get to ride, you know, a one-off, you know, trick, you know, pro circuit race bike, you also get to ride, you know, back in the day we rode some, you know, old KTMs before they got good that were didn't shift, you know, had lots of issues.
Right.
You know, just, you know, not everything was perfect.
Yeah, really. Is there one bike all those years that stands out as just being bitching? Like the first time you threw a leg on it, you're like, this is just incredible. I mean, was there anything that stood out like that?
I get asked that a lot, and there's three things I did that were super cool.
Yeah.
The first one was I got to ride one of Travis Pastrana's Works RM250s.
Uh-huh.
But instead of riding, you know, his works bike, Suzuki made it into my works bike with suspension for my weight, you know, my ability level.
Yeah.
So combined with an amazing engine, an amazing suspension, I mean, the bike was just, I remember going, turning laps at Glen Helen on it, and, you know, I didn't want to come back in. It was like, can I do a few more laps? Yeah. We're almost out of race gas. Okay, well, tell me when you're completely out. You know, and it just, I mean, it was just phenomenal. Probably my single best experience riding a bike overseas was I got a call from Terry Beal, who had my job at Yamaha, and it was like a Monday, and he said, hey, you have the opportunity to ride Stefan Everts, world champion, YZ250 and YZ450, but I need you to get on a plane tomorrow.
Oh, jeez.
And so it was like throw everything in a gear bag, you know, head to LAX, fly over, arrive in, you know, Milan, don't know anybody there, there's some guy with a little sign, go get to ride his bikes. And I mean,
yeah,
you know, I had never been to Europe. I was like 23 years old, didn't know anybody, you know, didn't know anything.
Right.
And then to go around a track and ride, you know, the world champion's bike and get to talk to the world champion at the time was...
Was that? Well, did he have the aluminum frames then, or no? Was it steel?
No. But it had a longer swing arm. It had a different. Yeah. I mean, it was the works bike. It had a different tranny, and just the most memorable part was the thing pulled so hard, but didn't have hit. So it was like so easy to ride because you could just roll it on, and it would just. I mean, everything was so easy on the bike. The brakes were so good. It was really cool.
Uh huh.
And the last trip was a trip I wish everyone who rides a dirt bike could do would be go to a factory. Watch them get built. Watch all the, you know, the care.
Your Yamaha story. Yeah.
Because, everybody just goes to the dealership, buys one, and, you know, rides it. Nobody sees, you know, them grab a frame off a rack, put it in a machine, which laser etches in the serial number, then put it on assembly line and watch, you know, all these people just add piece after piece after piece. I mean, it's just the coolest thing to see, and then watch this, you know, little old lady start it, run it through the gears, and then watch it go off to get boxed. It's like watching the birth of a dirt bike.
She had
nobody gets to see that.
She had like one boot on, right? Didn't you say?
They wear just a boot on the right, and
right.
Kick it over, a few kicks, and there's just a little tiny gas line hooked up to a little gas bottle.
Yeah.
Runs it through the gear, shuts it off, unplugs it, and bam.
That's hilarious. I remember that story. It was really cool. Definitely.
Yeah.
It sounded like you had great access. Didn't you go to their test track too?
Oh yeah, no. Yeah. Obviously that makes the story is when they give you access to where they test them.
Yeah.
They give you access to where the engines are built because the engines are built separate.
Uh huh.
So yeah, I mean that's like a clean room, like a sterile room, so that nothing gets involved. I mean, that was just I hoped at the time in that story that people would, you know, share the excitement of. I mean, this is the birth of a dirt bike. I mean, from
right.
The frame to riding on a track.
And have you been back since? And they know who you are. They're like, Tim's son, welcome back.
Yeah, I've been back three times with Yamaha.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of those things where it's like, oh, this is Tim's son. He worked for a motocross action. Oh yeah. You know, it's kind of funny the way it works.
Right. And also at MXA, I mean, when you started there. They were still pretty much the only magazine out there in 96, 97. You hadn't seen MX Racer yet. Dirt Rider was around, but they're a little bit more oriented towards the off-road thing. So what's your kind of take on the explosion of motocross magazines in the last 5-6 years?
I mean, I think it went hand-in-hand with the explosion of dirt bike sales.
Right.
I mean, our industry kind of suffered through, you know, 80s, early 90s, and then, I mean, I work for Yamaha, but I can't take Corehead. But starting in 96, you know, 97 aluminum frame CR250, 98 YZ400. I mean, the industry just took off for like a 10-year span.
Yeah, and now we're out.
Now we're there. Now we're there. But, I mean, I think that directly related with, you know, bike sales were shooting, which, you know, accessories were shooting through the roof, you know, gear was shooting, everything was shooting through the roof. So, yeah, I mean, Yeah, I remember seeing it was just like Dirt Bike, Dirt Rider, and us, and then MX Racers, you know, came up, Racer X, Trans World, you know, just
right.
I mean, to me, it's all good. It's more things to read. You know, I'm like anybody else. I, you know, get home or get to the office. Do they get the new issue of, you know?
Yeah. Of Trans World.
Actually, I was waiting on the digital copy of Racer X, which just came out today.
I think that was my last issue. I think I have some stories in there. And then so I've written a few things in there. That'll be the last one. But
you know, Tuesday, it's always like Tuesday after lunch. Did Cycle News come in? Yeah. I'm just like any other dirt bike guy. I'm always, you know.
Yeah, I can vouch for that.
Always looking for entertaining stories to read.
I can vouch for that. You are a fan for sure.
Yeah.
Now we talked about some of the best bikes. I guess what's it like testing some of the racers' bikes? MXA has always been known to get, directly race. I mean, I was at Yamaha when you were at MXA, and you guys tested Reed's bike, and it literally was washed and loaded into a van.
That's when I found the spark plug, didn't I? After I left the stand or something?
Yeah, we had that. That was the first year of unleaded gas, and we had that really funky gas where you had to rev the crap out of the thing to get up the temperature, and then the gas worked fine. But meantime, there were many plugs sacrificed in the meantime. But what was it like riding some of those bikes? Like, is there a couple that stick out? I mean, besides the Pastrana one, which you've said is the best one, is there another few that you can remember?
It's funny, they're mainly Carmichael's Honda 450 was phenomenal.
Yeah.
Other than, I mean, I remember writing in the story that they wouldn't let us touch it, and I couldn't run with his lever set up to save my soul, so I spent some time banging on it, trying to get it to where I liked it, which people got all mad at me. I remember reading comments going, why did he mess up? And it's like, because I wanted to ride it and have fun.
Yeah.
You know? I understand. But yeah, I remember his 252 stroke was the weirdest. I mean, it worked for him. He won titles on it.
Yeah.
But I rode it, and I was like, how would you ever ride? But I'm almost 6'1", and he's, what, 5'5", 5'6"?
Yeah.
So, and that was the time when he had, you know, the bars in his lap, levers straight up. I mean,
back end really low and everything.
Yeah. I mean, our sport goes through, you know, fads like that. But I remember riding Tim Ferry's 3-speed.
Yeah.
I was just like, I mean, I was like, this thing's awesome.
Yeah, 426.
Yeah, but outdoors, third was just a little too short. I mean, I know for pros it was way too short, but for my speed, I was like, nah, this thing's almost perfect. I remember riding McGrath's, I think it was 98, a Chaparral bike, and I remember crashing that and having to ride back into the pits to Bob Oliver and, you know, embarrassed as can be, going, I wrecked the radiator.
Yeah.
He's like, we have more of those. And I'm like, well, thanks for being nice to me, because I'm sure you're inside. You're going, eat this intermediate punk just wrecked this full race bike.
Now that we both know Oliver, that's exactly what he was thinking.
I mean, they're just – race bikes are race bikes. So you try and take him as, you know, this guy is, you know, unworthily fast.
Right.
The best in the world. I'm not. So certain things I'm going to love, certain things I'm going to hate. But I mean, you just try and build excitement. You know,
it's
built for that guy. It's not built for the average level rider.
Yeah, that's what I get. I get a lot of questions about that because I spent some time riding Ferry's Cowie, riding the Yamaha ones when I was there, and I get those questions too. And I'm like, you don't understand. It's not as simple as saying it's just so awesome. It's built. It's purpose built for supercross. Let's say so. You know, it's got a really short gearing and really abrupt power band, and it's built for a guy that's really, really fast. So it's not necessarily the best bike in the world for anyone, you know? That's kind of how I explain it.
Only for the rider who's riding it. Where production bikes, I mean, like our 450, we try and hit everybody. We want, you know, the 30 novice to be happy on it. We want the, you know, 250 intermediate who thinks he's going to be the next big thing to be happy.
Yeah.
Where on the race bike, they don't have those constraints. It's, we want James Stewart to be happy. Here's an engine that makes him, you know, a second lap faster.
Right. So we covered the best race bikes. We covered the best production bikes. What about the worst bikes, Olsen? Which ones do you remember just not being that good? Or as Jody told you some stories about some ones that maybe weren't that good back in the day, but do you have any of that?
I'm trying to think of some of the worst. They were never.
Cause that's the
one thing, is that like bikes like the 80s, they were like huge hits and misses.
Right.
I mean, I remember like when I tested, I think 1992 YZ125.
Yeah,
it couldn't get out of its own way. I mean, here Jeff Emick, who was like, he wasn't my hero, but I dug his riding style.
Right.
And he's winning races on it, and I, you know, sign up at the GFI Winter Series, thinking I'm going to get, you know, huge contingency money, and I'm like 25th out of 26 going into every first corner, crashed a million times trying to make something happen.
Right.
I'm like, this thing's just a pile. I mean, I remember Ed Scheidler, who used to be the technician here, he built me so many bikes trying to make it fast, and it was just Emig was that good.
Yeah. No, I remember you should go wander down and talk to Bob about that bike, because it was like a Honda Piston and a Suzuki Ignition or something. It was all bell zoned up and brand new ports. He told me one time that bike took him so many hours to try to make fast. It was incredible. So
I remember like Cowie 125s in 93. I kept seasoned pistons, so that was always frustrating.
Yeah.
I mean, everything had its own little quirks.
Did what about the Cannondale?
You know, I tested. I was the guy in the photos. And, I mean, it was the biggest problem with the Cannondale was it was so hyped up and it so under-delivered.
Right.
Which is, I mean, obviously we were worried about those same things because our bike, you know, press photos leaked, or not press photos, but drawings leaked in May, and we weren't going to announce the bike until September. So you never want to build up a ton of hype.
Yeah.
But we knew we weren't going to under-deliver, so that was the only, you know, we'd all read it and go, no, this thing works. But it wasn't horrible, but it was, you know, it didn't work. And at the time, our 426 was pretty spectacular, so
yeah.
It's kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
I mean, it was ahead of its time, but never got a chance to mature.
Yeah, I remember MXA particularly really ripping into it. I don't know if you wrote that story. It might have been Jody, but yeah.
I'm sure we all kind of helped write it. But, I mean, that's the biggest problem, is it was hyped up as the greatest thing. I remember Dirt Rider proclaimed it the bike of the year, and it's never been on a track.
Yeah, they did. That was a curious move for sure. What else? KX125s, YZ125s. Did you ever get flack from a manufacturer? A guy like you back then would call you up and tear you a new one for something you wrote?
I mean, yeah, that went with a turf. I mean,
there
were plenty. I mean, everybody's heard the Suzuki stories with Yamaha. I mean, with MXA.
Yeah, maybe talk about that a little bit.
Well, I knew you wanted to, so I brought it up for you. Safe to be.
I like it. I mean, it's a good one.
It's like what I always say as a journalist, I just try and write the truth.
Right.
You know, and now that I work at Yamaha, you know, sometimes I don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as you're writing the truth, I can go, I understand. That is, you know, that's the way it is.
Right.
And, you know, the Suzuki stuff, you know, we were writing the truth. They didn't like it. And so, you know.
It's that time. Time for a commercial. Sorry, guys. Got to pay the bills.
Thanks for listening to the BTOsports.com podcast show. Please don't forget that BTO is the world leader in aftermarket motocross parts for the bike or body. You'll find deals like a Shoei VFXW helmet for $309.99, 45% off, or Smith Piston goggles for $32.99, 65% off. Your order can be shipped to anywhere in the USA for free, or if you're not in the USA, we ship worldwide. Check it out at BTOsports.com.
What was it that set them off? What test of what bike?
I don't. It happened like three times. I don't remember. The time when I was there that set it off was we, at the time the Yamaha YZ400 was the big, you know, was the big thing. KTM came out with a 400. Suzuki had the DRZ400, which was an off-road, you know, bike, but not a, you know, a race bike.
Right.
And so, you know, all the magazines were getting them and trying to turn them into race bikes, you know, putting RM suspension.
Well, the GNCC guys were racing them, in effect.
Yeah. That's what we were all doing. Well, we did the same thing, but, you know, we made some comments that, you know, you can't turn a – the main thing that they got them at, I think, was like garbage scow or something, but I don't remember what the term. But they took offense, and there's nothing wrong with that,
Yeah.
I agree, and their tactic to, you know, not necessarily punish us, but their tactic was to yank all their bikes.
And they really, that was it. You guys weren't allowed to test them.
Yeah, that wasn't it. But, of course, being a magazine guy and going to the, you know, REM every Saturday, somebody's going to buy an RM125, an RM250.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not hard to say, hey, you just bought that bike. You know, can we go out and test it?
But, I mean, like, what the hell was Suzuki thinking? Like, especially, you know, MXA being really the only mag out there that torture tests these bikes. I mean, it kind of doesn't seem like a smart move, regardless good or bad, you know?
You get pushed into a corner and you want to react. Sometimes cooler heads don't prevail.
Right. So you ended up testing them anyways, though, right?
Every year we tested them. It wasn't hard to find guys with. I mean, especially, you know, being that we raced every weekend and rode Glen Helen every Thursday and did all that, You know, there were guys who were like, you know, they were Suzuki fans, but they thought it was hilarious. So we'd get calls all the time. Hey, I just got my Suzuki. You want to meet me out and test it? So, I mean, it was, to be honest, it was kind of comical at the time. But, you know, I can understand how it happened.
Right.
But, yeah, that's definitely not the best course of action.
Pulling the bikes, you mean? Yeah. No. Yeah, I don't really understand that. So how many years did that? You said it happened three times for a couple of years at a time.
Yeah,
or something,
I mean,
or?
When I was there, it only happened. It was like 90. I'm trying to think of when that. It was like 98, 99. I think was the years we were. But we had just gotten back Suzukis after something else. But that was like I think 89.
Yeah.
They also got. I mean, it just flip flopped. It was just one of those things where it was, you know, an ongoing love hate relationship, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. What's it like working with Jody Weisel? I don't really know him that well. I've spoken to him a few times. He turned me down for a podcast, which is understandable. But what's it like working with him? He just must be like an encyclopedia of moto, huh?
One of the smartest men I've ever met.
Uh-huh.
Probably one of the most passionate motocross guys you'll ever meet. I mean, considering this guy, I mean, I'm 35 and I've been riding since I was 5, you know.
Yeah.
He's in his 60s and has been riding since his 15, so he's got, you know, 45 years on a dirt bike. Most guys come and go in our sport. So, and he races, you know, every Saturday without fail at RAM. So,
yeah.
He was actually a really easy guy to work with. I have no complaints. He would say, hey, we need these stories. You do it. He'd leave you alone. I mean, as far as the bosses goes.
Yeah.
He was probably the best boss I ever had. He was super easy. When you did something wrong, he'd let you know, but he didn't yell. He didn't, you know, he would just be like, you know you need this done, right? Yeah, I know I need to get it done. And then, you know, he'd let you have, you know, the day where you wouldn't do anything. And then he'd be like, you know, you really need to get this done.
He'd give you some rope to see if you'd hang yourself.
Yeah. I know he's another one of those, he's like, you know, hot or cold, you love him or you hate him. But, man, I grew up with a guy from when, you know, I was 5 years old.
Right.
As far as I can tell, he has never done anything that, you know, would get him a hate reputation.
Yeah.
Sure, he doesn't make everybody a fan, but his main goal, as is every magazine's main goal, is to give the consumer the most informed opinion possible.
Right. I can just imagine sitting around having some beers with him and just, like, listening to the stories would be awesome, and that's what I was trying to get on a podcast show. I mean, you know, just the guy's done so much.
He went to every race in the 70s and early 80s. I mean, he...
Yeah.
He was there when they were all traveling in vans, and I guarantee you that was probably the heyday of the storytelling.
Yeah, really. Huh?
Now everybody flies in, flies out. Before, I mean, you lived with a guy. It was like, you know, box van, you'd drive from point A to point B, get out, ride for a couple of days,
go to
the race. You know, so you were, I mean, it was a, I mean, it's still a tight-knit group because riding dirt bikes kind of, you know.
Right.
Anybody who rides a dirt bike is in the group. You know,
we're
small enough to where it's like, he rides that. He's not part of our group. It's like, no, we're all dirt bikers.
Right. What about the wars with the Supercross promoters? Were you around for that, or what?
No, that was over right before I started.
Okay.
Literally, I think, 96, they were out, but I started at the end of April, so Supercross season was just over.
Uh-huh.
So that was another thing. I mean, Jody told what he believed was the truth. And
right.
Supercross promoters didn't agree, and, you know, the only real power they have is we're not going to give you access.
Did they really do that? They really banned MXA? I mean, really?
Yeah.
I heard it. I read it in a magazine, but I didn't know how far it actually went. Like, hey, we're going to threaten to ban you, or no, you're banned.
It's pretty simple ban. You just don't get a press credential. That one doesn't take hard, but, I mean, it's like anything.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I mean, how many freelancers are out there? How hard is it to get a story? Not very hard.
Yeah. No,
so
definitely.
Like, unless you ban every freelancer, every, you know, freelance photographer, you know. I mean, the journalism part, you really can never shut them out because, you know, there's just no way that they're not going to get the story they want to get.
See,
your best bet is to work with them and try and...
Don't shut me out, Olson. I'll get the story.
I'm never talking to you again after this. We're done.
What about one of the things MXA is also known for is the product tests. You know, a lot of one stars over the years. Is there anything that you remember that sort of either got you in hot water or got an advertiser unhappy, or any product out there that you can talk about that was terrible?
Nothing I want to talk about, but yes, I had many a meeting over one or two stars, and the one or two star thing, that was actually, I can't take full credit, but I'm like, we need to do kind of a real rating system, not just our opinion, but something that people can hang on to and know that, you know.
Right.
And the biggest thing is if everybody gets five-star means nothing.
Yeah.
You know, but if you get a five-star and somebody else gets a one-star, that means something. So, there were definitely a few, and I definitely will not bring up any names because they're all still in the industry. But, yeah, no, I was in quite a few meetings over how could you possibly give? Do you know how much we spent on molds on that product? Do you know? You know.
Yeah.
But it's like, hey, I'm just telling you, you know.
I'm guessing that Jody had your back for most of those. You know what I mean?
I mean, magazines, everybody always has to have their back. You can't ever. I mean, that's what we always laugh at. It's like, well, who wrote the story? Well, there's only three people that work in the magazine, and it's one voice.
Right.
So regardless of who writes it, you're all in it together.
Yeah. Is that sort of the reasoning, the thinking behind the bylines thing that drives some people mad? You know, there's not a lot of bylines in there.
They always did the editorial we.
Right.
But a we of only three people isn't exactly a huge we.
Yeah, exactly.
No, it's not like it's real hard to go, okay, now which one is it?
Yeah, exactly. So, you spent many years there. What made you want to leave? You went to motocross.com. What was the decision behind that switch or thought process?
Well, you know, I just like anything else, I was getting into my 30s.
Yeah.
Had a wife. Kid was on the way. Decided I want to go do, you know, my own thing. And at the time, motocross.com was owned by Wasserman Media Group, which was a big powerhouse. They owned The Family, which is a huge agency in motocross. And I just thought, given the access with the athletes that it would have, and you know the money they had behind them, it would actually turn out to be a really, really positive thing.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't. It wasn't.
I just quickly realized that, the plan wasn't as far along as what it needed to be. And the internet is a really hard. I mean, you should know better than anybody. It's easy to put a ton of content out there to get paid for the content. However,
yeah,
way more difficult and get advertisers behind the content.
Yeah,
is even more difficult. So
I know we're in a weird area in journalism right now. That way,
Same reasons why I went to it.
Yeah.
For the same reasons why, you know, I've got a family. I need to provide for them. I need a stable job that I enjoy, that I don't have to worry about, you know, financial backers going, you know, we tried that. We spent a lot of money on it, but, you know, we're not getting the whatever it is, page views or unique users that we need. So we're going to go a different direction.
Yeah. No, it's painful to write a 4,000-word column, which I just did, and then...
Oh, don't do that for the internet. Anything longer than a couple paragraphs and you're wasting your time.
Four days later, it's disappeared forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. It is a little painful. I do wonder what the hell I'm doing sometimes when I'm punching away at 2 in the morning. You know,
Twitter, 140 characters or less.
Sometimes I'll be like, I have to make this point about Trey Carnard. I just have to. And then, like, 2 days later, it's gone. My point that I was so... believe so strongly and is gone forever. Nobody cares.
It's not gone, and it's one Google search away.
Well, I don't think anybody's Googling it, though, Olson.
Probably not.
So how's your relationship with the MXA Wrecking Crew these days?
It's as good as it is with any other magazine. I still go out and race REMs because I enjoy it.
Uh-huh.
They're typically out there, so.
Right.
You know, my dad still rides MXA bikes. So.
Yeah, so no hard feelings when you leave.
No, that was all on good terms. No, I mean, I... talked to Jody about it. I talked to the owner, Roland Hines, before I left. I mean,
right?
No qualms there.
What's your opinion of MXA these days? What do you think about the magazine? And I mean, you've had so many years there and so many years growing up in it. You have to still feel a little bit of like looking at an old photo of your girlfriend or something. I mean,
I'm weird in that way. I'm not really much of a nostalgic kind of guy. I don't really look back. I move forward more. It's like people always ask me about like vintage bikes and this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
That's not my thing. I'm always like, what's the new, greatest, latest, you know?
Right.
So, no, I mean, I look at it, I read it, you know?
Yeah.
I don't think when I left it fell apart.
Right.
It's still as good as it ever was.
Yeah. What about in your time at MXA, I mean, we all know how MXA is. They're definitely a little more of the harder core magazine. Did you ever get flack at the races from riders or people for things that either Jody wrote or Basher wrote or somebody at MXA wrote, but they associated you with MXA? I mean, did you ever sort of have to put your defending hat on and explain something?
Yeah, but that's the same at any company.
I have to go
somebody
through it, too.
Somebody says the YZ450 sucks, and I didn't build it, but I'm the first one to say, what are you talking about?
Right.
Yeah, no, it happened all the time. I mean, I'm trying to think. The worst one was Casey Johnson.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I forget what we said about Casey Johnson, but at one Supercross, man, he wanted to come and kill me, and I'm like, what is your problem?
But you're like, I didn't even write that, or maybe you did. Yeah, I don't know.
I probably did. I mean,
yeah.
It's like anything. It's like, you know, they're racers. They're doing a job. You know, my boss doesn't, you know, come in and say, you're the greatest this ever lived. It's like, well, you did this good, but you really did this poorly. So, you know, you need to work on that.
Right.
That's kind of the same thing. MXA, if you do something great, they're going to say it. If you do something poorly, they're going to say it as well.
I kind of think that I'm the same way a little bit, you know, but I get a lot of flack, and I think our industry needs more MXAs. Not necessarily, and you're maybe not going to agree with me, but not necessarily the view of...
Doesn't our sport need more trans worlds?
No, I mean more of a critical look of our sport. Yeah, more trans worlds for sure. But no, I mean a little bit more of a critical look of the sport. But I feel MXA goes to the point of, like, everything 10 years ago was better. Everything. We walked the school uphill both ways, and we were tougher, meaner, nastier, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not asking you to comment on that because they're your buddies. But I do feel our sport needs a little bit more critical look at it. Do you agree?
I definitely would agree that if our athletes were in any other sport with the kind of scrutiny those athletes get, it would be an eye-opener.
Why are we not all like that, do you think? Is it just too small?
Because it's too small of a world.
Yeah.
And we all have to see each other every week, week in and week out.
Yeah. Okay.
Huh. So, I mean, that's just part. I mean, we're more of a traveling circus than, say, you know, the NBA or the, you know, the NBA, they have a press conference after you know, a game in Salt Lake City. All the press from Salt Lake City. They don't see him again for, you know, however long, where our sport, we don't get the mainstream press like that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's you, Cox, you know, Guyberson asking, you know, James Stewart the same questions that everyone, you know.
Yeah.
You know that if you say something really negative, the next time you ask James Stewart a question, he's probably more than likely going to give you a real short answer and move on.
Yeah, I know. I just wish it wasn't like that, though, Olson. I wish maybe you could help your riders. And I mean, does that get brought up? Are you, I mean, in my dealings with a Stewart, you know, I mostly deal with Brooks or Stewart himself, just because it's easier that way than going through you. But are you
not easy going through me?
No. Well, I'm just, it's more direct. I don't have to wait a day or whatever, you know? Have you had to step in there in your new job at a few different times, not just with Stewart, but with different riders? And what kind of advice do you give them? I mean, has anybody called you up and been like, you know, Transworld said this about me and F them or whatever. Have you ever had that come up in your new job?
I mean, it's just like anything. It's just like editors. Everybody has egos. So, yeah, some riders, of course.
Right.
You know, how could they say this? But, I mean,
I imagine you're pretty good at diffusing it, though, because you're like,
well, I say the same thing, kind of what I live by. It's like, well, if that's the way they see it, obviously there's some aspect of that that's in there,
right?
And it's up to you to change it.
And how does that go over?
Well, most of them are totally understand. I mean, most of them are just like any other, you know.
Yeah.
Guy, you know, I don't want people to think that, you know, I'm Tim Olson. I've got this, you know, great job, and I don't care about the average guy. So.
Yeah.
You know, I try and treat everybody the same, regardless of, you know, who they are or what level they're at, because that's the way I'd want to be treated.
I think you could really help with anybody at, you know, if any rider or team came to you and was upset at a member of the media, you could probably have a great outlook on that as far as what to do, why that happened, what's next, you know what I mean, just from your experience. So I think that would really help.
Yeah, I think for the most part, things are pretty good in that respect.
Right. What's it like trying to balance, trying to get James Stewart to do something for you, or not just what's it like with trying to deal with an athlete like James that is constantly pulled in 8 million different directions by either his posse or his own team, and then you have Yamaha's interests? Is it a bit of a shell game sometimes?
No, I mean, actually, it's really easy. You just got to know that the guy's got a calendar that's set in stone from 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got to work within, you know, that schedule. Other than that, no, he's been, knock on wood, he has been a treat. Like, we always, you know, obviously our brochure shoots and stuff, James and all of those.
Right.
He comes in, easy to deal with, hangs out with the crew, you know, has lunch with, you know, there's no, he's not, you know, into the whole, you know, I'm a star, you can't, you know, talk to me or see
right,
me.
Right, yeah.
He has been super easy at the races. I mean, he's like, you know, anybody else. When you're at work, you know, you want to focus on doing the best job you can. And,
yeah,
you know, obviously his job deals with dealing with, you know, people just like mine deals with dealing with media. So he's got to, you know, always present. But sometimes you have bad days at work, you know, you're not going to be so friendly. Other days you have great days at work and, you know, you talk up a storm and, you know, you get great interviews that go way longer than you thought they would.
Right.
Other days you get the yes, no, no, yes, I don't know.
The one thing I feel sorry for a guy like James or Reedy or anybody is the, you know, they sign autographs for an hour and there's somebody that's not going to get an autograph. And now that somebody is pissed. And, I mean, those guys could literally be there all night long. And, you know, maybe not everybody wouldn't get their autograph. So you got to draw a line somewhere for resting, for eating, you know, all that. They're trying to win the race.
I mean, that's where, I mean, Stewart does a pretty good job. I don't know when they came up with a system where they give out tickets. But it's like, you know, first come, first serve, get a ticket. You know, if you have a ticket, James will sign. And, I mean, yeah, I agree with you that if James didn't have some kind of way of cutting the line off.
Right.
He would be signing autographs from 10 in the morning till, you know, 5 minutes before the first heat race starts.
Right, right. Yeah, so, I just, you know. I feel sorry for those guys in a little bit.
Cause I agree.
You always see that, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's everybody's, well, it's just an autograph. Well, yeah, I agree, and I would sign every, but, you know, just an autograph for 45,000 people is a lot of autographs.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. Now, I'm not sure when this podcast is going to go up, but what are your thoughts from A1? It might be up after Phoenix, but what are your thoughts on the first round?
I mean, from Yamaha's point,
from your
awesome,
yeah.
5 out of the top 10, Yamaha, you know, on the box, on the top of the box.
Right.
From a fan's perspective, it was a great race.
Yeah,
you know, I want to see races like anybody else. To see, you know, Dungey up there challenging Stewart. I mean, it was just awesome to see Wyndham, you know, riding up to where most of us would like to see Wyndham riding.
Right.
You know, I really had no. And I wish the lights would have been a little more of a, you know, a battle, but they spread out pretty quick other than Kennard's move on, you know, Morris.
Mm-hmm.
But, no, I mean, that to me was one of the better Anaheim ones. I mean, to me, Stewart crashing last year, that, you know, all it meant was he had to play catch-up. It wasn't a great race. It was, you know, that was a bummer. I mean, Josh Grant winning his first Supercross, that was awesome.
Well, with a hay bale stuck in his rear brake, too.
Oh, I was so scared for that guy.
I know.
Please.
What was the top lights guy, the Yamaha?
Brock Tickle, 6th.
Okay, and he won a heat. That was cool.
He won the heat race, and he, you know, he got a bad start in the main event.
Yeah, and Paul Lynn was 4th until Kennard introduced him to American Supercross. But
yeah, he was welcome to America. This is how we turn. Or don't turn, I mean.
But Paul Lynn certainly looked good. He looked like he was legit. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so he should do
Yamaha
well.
Yamaha has, we were talking about this in-house, Yamaha has our best racing effort ever, probably this year.
I like it to think it was better when I was there. But, I mean, that's just me.
No, it was better when Tim Ferry was here. Not so much you.
Not so much me. A lot of podiums in 03, 04. I'll tell you what, between the whole Reedy, Villam, and Ferry combo.
Whoa. How many of those were Ferry and how many of those were Villam and Reedy?
Listen, Ferry had 11 podiums in 03 in both series combined. It's pretty good out of 30-some races. It's almost
good. Yeah, but how many were you at?
I was in all of them.
Oh. I figured there's a fill-in mechanic or something.
Well, there was when I had my little green card issue. Bob took him to a podium.
Oh, there you go. How many other podiums were when Bob was there?
Just one with Oliver.
Damn
you and your memory, Olsen.
Yeah.
Well, cool, man. Thanks for doing this. I always wanted to get you, and I know you were avoiding it for a while, but.
I was never avoiding it.
Just busy.
Picking the right time. Yeah. Well,
I know.
You know it is. You're busy too. Supercross has started. Yeah.
I know. Lots of typing.
the good stuff.
Yeah, I just did a Ron Dungy interview today and a breakdown of A1 for my Italian magazine, so there we go.
Whatever you do, don't call Yamaha WaZeds, that's all I ask.
Yeah, that's when I went to Montreal, it was kind of funny because I sat through the Yamaha intro up there, and they just kept saying YZ over and over and over, and I was just like, this is bizarre. You know, but whatever. Tim Olson, Factory Yamaha Media Relations. Thank you.
Go out and ride.
Go out and buy blue and go ride, right?
Go out and ride, and hopefully it's blue.
Well, wait, or it could be white. It could be white.
Could be white. Could be yellow and black if it's an 06 limited edition model.
Yeah, I wish they did that again. I like that. I guess it was only that for 50 years, right? Was that the deal?
Yep. That was 50th anniversary, limited edition, 06.
Yeah, so I would have been there then, so I should have known that. Cool. Well, thank you, Tim Olson, and will I see you this weekend in Phoenix, or?
You're going to REM, is that what you said?
No, I am going to Phoenix, so I guess I won't see you at
I'll
Phoenix.
I'll see you Thursday at the James Stewart press conference at Anaheim 2.
Oh, is there one? I didn't know.
And we're giving away a YZ450 at that. We're not giving it at that race, but James is going to race it at that race, so we're a little excited about the black frame, black swing arm, all-white James Stewart design.
Oh, he's going to actually race that bike.
He is racing it at Anaheim 2 and Anaheim 2 only.
Nice.
After that, he'll be back on his standard blue edition.
I saw that. That thing looks pretty trick. Yeah.
It's very cool. I mean, that was all on James. We said, hey, you know, you want to do this? And he said, yeah, but I want to make it a little different. And we're like, run with it.
Yeah. Cool.
So what he came back with, I think, is, definitely very unique. And I'll be stoked when a guy wins it after Vegas.
Oh, so, okay, I was going to ask you. Yeah, so Vegas is, you'll be giving it away then?
Yeah, shortly after Vegas. I don't have the, but yeah, right. We're doing the collection throughout the whole Supercross series and in the magazines. And
right.
After that, James will pick the winner personally. So
I'm going to enter, see if I can win.
Yeah, actually, you can because you're no longer a Yamaha employee. So
Yep, exactly.
Although if he picks your name, no, that won't happen.
That's probably not going to happen. You'll just grab it and be like Bob Smith.
You're like, wait a minute, that's a mistake.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Tim Olson. Well, thank you for doing the PTO Sports Transworld Motocross podcast. I really appreciate it, and I'll see you around.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been the BTOsports.com podcast show, brought to you by Transworld Motocross. Don't forget to check out some of our past shows, including motocross legends such as
The Beast from the East, Damon Bradshaw.
It got to the point to where I didn't want to leave home, and once I got to the race, I wasn't into it. If I wasn't going to give 100%, I'm not going to take their money.
The working class hero, Doug Henry.
It was definitely an emotional moment for me, just thinking to myself, that's it, you know, and it's amazing the stuff that goes through your head in a short amount of time of the things that, you know, that I was going to miss.
The Dogger, Ron Machine.
Until you really open your ears and you want to listen to what they're saying, it's like beating a dead horse. I mean, you know, and I know from personal experience, did anybody ever sit me down? Of course they did. Everybody did.
Pro Circuits, Mitch Payton.
There's two ways to make the money. One is you can sign for money, or two, you can earn the money. I'm a high believer in earning the money. I think they ride better when they earn the money.
Seven-time Jeremy McGrath.
I was so mad, like so disappointed and so frustrated that I pulled the pick and I left. Every point counts. I could kick myself to this day for not just riding around in tents. It's been no problem. My ego got in the way, you know?
The O Show, Johnny O'Mara.
Stuff that you'd sit there if you didn't even want to ride it, you just wanted to just look at it all day. I mean, I got a chance to test all that. I like that era I was in. I really do.
Search Mathis on the iTunes Store to find these and many more great podcasts. I won't let this die. You know I've got this.